Chapter 35. It was known in Rome that Caesar wished to see Ostia on the journey, or rather the largest ship in the world, which had brought wheat recently from Alexandria, and from Ostia to go by the Via Litoralis to Antium. Orders had been given a number of days earlier, hence at the Porta Ostiensis, from early morning, crowds made up of the local rabble, and of all nations of the earth, had collected to feast their eyes with the sight of Caesar's retinue, on which the Roman population could never gaze sufficiently. The road to Antium was neither difficult nor long. In the place itself, which was composed of palaces and villas built and furnished in a lordly manner, it was possible to find everything demanded by comfort, and even the most exquisite luxury of the period. Caesar had the habit, however, of taking with him on a journey every object in which he found delight, beginning with musical instruments and domestic furniture, and ending with statues and mosaics, which were taken even when he wished to remain on the road merely a short time for rest or recreation. He was accompanied, therefore, on every expedition by whole legions of servants, without reckoning divisions of Praetorian guards and Augustians. Of the latter each had a personal retinue of slaves. Early on the morning of that day herdsmen from the Campania, with sunburnt faces, wearing goatskins on their legs, drove forth 500 chiasses through the gates, so that Poppaea on the morrow of her arrival at Antium might have her bath in their milk. The rabble gazed with delight and ridicule at the long ears swaying amid clouds of dust, and listened with pleasure to the whistling of whips, and the wild shouts of the herdsmen. After the asses had gone by, crowds of youth rushed forth, swept the road carefully, uncovered it with flowers and needles from pine trees. In the crowds people whispered to each other, with a certain feeling of pride, that the whole road to Antium would be strewn in that way with flowers taken from private gardens round about, or bought at high prices from dealers at the Porta Muginus. As the morning hours passed, the throng increased every moment. Some had brought their whole families, and, lest the time might seem tedious, they spread provisions on stones intended for the new temple of Ceres, and ate their prandium beneath the open sky. Here and there were groups, in which the lead was taken by persons who had traveled. They talked of Caesar's present trip, of his future journeys, and journeys in general. Sailors and old soldiers narrated wonders which during distant campaigns they had heard about countries which a Roman foot had never touched. Homestayers, who had never gone beyond the Appian Way, listened with amazement to marvelous tales of India, of Arabia, of archipelagos surrounding Britain in which, on a small island inhabited by spirits, Briareus had imprisoned the sleeping Saturn. They heard of Hyperborean regions of stiffened seas, of the hisses and roars which the ocean gives forth when the sun plunges into his bath. Stories of this kind found ready credence among the rabble, stories believed by such men even as Tacitus and Pliny. They spoke also of that ship which Caesar was to look at, a ship which had brought wheat, to last for 2 years, without reckoning 400 passengers, an equal number of soldiers, and a multitude of wild beasts, to be used during the summer games. This produced general good feeling toward Caesar, who not only nourished the populace, but amused it. Hence a greeting full of enthusiasm was waiting for him. Meanwhile came a detachment of Numidian horse, who belonged to the Praetorian Guard. They wore yellow uniforms, red girdles, and great earrings, which cast a golden gleam on their black faces. The points of their bamboo spears glittered like flames in the sun. After they had passed, a procession-like movement began. The throng crowded forward to look at it more nearly, but divisions of Praetorian foot were there, and, forming in line on both sides of the gate, prevented approach to the road. In advance moved wagons carrying tents, purple, red, and violet, and tents of byssus woven from threads as white as snow, and oriental carpets, and tables of citrus, and pieces of mosaic, and kitchen utensils, and cages with birds from the east, north, and west, birds whose tongues or brains were to go to Caesar's table, and vessels with wine and baskets with fruit. but objects not to be exposed to bruising or breaking in vehicles were borne by slaves. Hence hundreds of people were seen on foot, carrying vessels and statues of Corinthian bronze. There were companies appointed specially to Etruscan vases, others to Grecian, others to golden or silver vessels, or vessels of Alexandrian glass. These were guarded by small detachments of Praetorian infantry and cavalry. Over each division of slaves were taskmasters, holding whips armed at the end with lumps of lead or iron, instead of snappers. The procession, formed of men bearing with importance and attention various objects, seemed like some solemn religious procession, and the resemblance grew still more striking when the musical instruments of Caesar and the court were borne past. There were seen harps, Grecian lutes, lutes of the Hebrews and Egyptians, lyres, flamingas, citharas, flutes, long, winding buffalo horns and cymbals. While looking at that sea of instruments, gleaming beneath the sun in gold, bronze, precious stones, and pearls, it might be imagined that Apollo and Bacchus had set out on a journey through the world. After the instruments came rich chariots filled with acrobats, dancers male and female, grouped artistically, with wands in their hands. After them followed slaves intended, not for service, but excess. So there were boys and little girls, selected from all Greece and Asia Minor, with long hair, or with winding curls arranged in golden nets, children resembling Cupids, with wonderful faces, but faces covered completely with a thick coating of cosmetics, lest the wind of the Campania might tan their delicate complexions. And again appeared a Praetorian cohort of gigantic Sicambrians, blue-eyed, bearded, blonde and red-haired. In front of them Roman eagles were carried by banner-bearers called Mycenaria, tablets with inscriptions, statues of German and Roman gods, and finally statues and busts of Caesar. From under the skins and armor of the soldier appeared limbs sunburned and mighty, looking like military engines capable of wielding the heavy weapons with which guards of that kind were furnished. The earth seemed to bend beneath their measured and weighty tread. As if conscious of strength which they could use against Caesar himself, they looked with contempt on the rabble of the street, forgetting, it was evident, that many of themselves had come to that city in manacles. But they were insignificant in numbers, for the Praetorian force had remained in camp specially to guard the city and hold it within bounds. When they had marched past, Nero's chained lions and tigers were led by, so that, should the wish come to him of imitating Dionysus, he would have them to attach to his chariots. They were led in chains of steel by Arabs and Hindus, but the chains were so entwined with garlands that the beasts seemed led with flowers. The lions and tigers, tamed by skilled trainers, looked at the crowds with green and seemingly sleepy eyes. But at moments they raised their giant heads, and breathed through wheezing nostrils the exhalations of the multitude, licking their jaws the while with spiny tongues. Now came Caesar's vehicles and litters, great and small, gold or purple, inlaid with ivory or pearls, or glittering with diamonds. After them came another small cohort of Praetorians in Roman armor, Praetorians composed of Italian volunteers only. One then crowds of select slave servants, and boys, and at last came Caesar himself, whose approach was heralded from afar by the shouts of thousands. In the crowd was the Apostle Peter, who wished to see Caesar once in life. He was accompanied by Lygia, whose face was hidden by a thick veil, and Ursus, whose strength formed the surest defense of the young girl in the wild and boisterous crowd. The Lygian seized a stone, to be used in building the temple, and brought it to the apostle, so that by standing on it, he might see better than others. The crowd muttered when Ursus pushed it apart, as a ship pushes waves, but when he carried the stone, which four of the strongest men could not raise, the muttering was turned into wonderment, and cries of "Act!" were heard round about. Meanwhile Caesar appeared. He was sitting in a chariot drawn by six white Idumean stallions shod with gold. The chariot had the form of a tent with sides open, purposely, so that the crowds could see Caesar. A number of persons might have found place in the chariot, But Nero, desiring that attention should be fixed on him exclusively, passed through the city alone, having at his feet merely two deformed dwarfs. He wore a white tunic, and a toga of amethyst color, which cast a bluish tinge on his face. On his head was a laurel wreath. Since his departure from Naples he had increased notably in body. His face had grown wide. Under his lower jaw hung a double chin, by which his mouth, always too near his nose, seemed to touch his nostrils. His bulky neck was protected, as usual, by a silk kerchief, which he arranged from moment to moment with a white and fat hand grown over with red hair, forming as it were bloody stains. He would not permit Appillators to pluck out this hair, since he had been told that to do so would bring trembling of the fingers and injure his lute playing. Measureless vanity was depicted then, as at all times, on his face, together with tedium and suffering. On the whole, it was a face both terrible and trivial. While advancing he turned his head from side to side, blinking at times, and listening carefully to the manner in which the multitude greeted him. He was met by a storm of shouts and applause: colon, hail, divine Caesar, liberator, hail, conqueror. Hail, incomparable! Son of Apollo, Apollo himself! When he heard these words, he smiled, but at moments a cloud, as it were, passed over his face, for the Roman rabble was satirical, unkeen in reckoning, and let itself criticize even great triumphators, even men whom it loved and respected. It was known that on a time they shouted during the entrance to Rome of Julius Caesar: colon, citizens, hide your wives, the old libertine is coming. But Nero's monstrous vanity could not endure the least blame or criticism. Meanwhile in the throng, amid shouts of applause were heard cries of Ahenobarbus, Ahenobarbus! Where hast thou put thy flaming beard? Dost thou fear that Rome might catch fire from it? And those who cried out in that fashion knew not that their jest concealed a dreadful prophecy. These voices did not anger Caesar overmuch, since he did not wear a beard, for long before he had devoted it in a golden cylinder to Jupiter Capitolinus. But other persons, hidden behind piles of stones and the corners of temples, shouted: colon, matricide! Nero! Orestes! Alcmaeon! And still others: colon, where is Octavia? Surrender the purple! At Poppaea, who came directly after him, they shouted, Flava Coma, yellow hair, with which name they indicated a streetwalker. Caesar's musical ear caught these exclamations also, and he raised the polished emerald to his eyes, as if to see and remember those who uttered them. While looking thus, his glance rested on the apostle standing on the stone. For a while those two men looked at each other. It occurred to no one in that brilliant retinue, and to no one in that immense throng, that at that moment two powers of the earth were looking at each other, one of which would vanish quickly as a bloody dream, and the other, dressed in simple garments, would seize in eternal possession the world and the city. Meanwhile Caesar had passed, and immediately after him eight Africans bore a magnificent litter, in which sat Poppaea, who was detested by the people. Arrayed, as was Nero, in amethyst color, with a thick application of cosmetics on her face, immovable, thoughtful, indifferent, she looked like some beautiful and wicked divinity carried in procession. In her wake followed a whole court of servants, male and female, next a line of wagons bearing materials of dress and news. The sun had sunk sensibly from midday, when the passage of Augustians began, a brilliant, glittering line gleaming like an endless serpent. The indolent Petronius, greeted kiddedly by the multitude, had given command to bear him and his godlike slave in a litter. Tigellinus went in a chariot drawn by ponies ornamented with white and purple feathers. They saw him as he rose in the chariot repeatedly, and stretched his neck to see if Caesar was preparing to give him the sign to his chariot. Among others, THC crowd greeted Licinianus with applause, Vitellius with laughter, Vatinius with hissing. Towards Licinus and Licanius the consuls they were indifferent, but Tullius Senecia they loved, it was unknown why, and Vestinius received applause. The court was innumerable. Does it seem that all that was richest, most brilliant and noted in Rome, was migrating to Annum? Nero never traveled otherwise than with thousands of vehicles. The society which accompanied him almost always exceeded the number of soldiers in a legion. Too, hence Domitius Afer appeared, and the decrepit Lucius Saturninus, and Vespasian, who had not gone yet on his expedition to Judea, from which he returned for the crown of Caesar, and his sons, and young Nerva, and Lucan, and Annius Gallo, and Quintianus, and a multitude of women renowned for wealth, beauty, luxury, and vice. The eyes of the multitude were turned to the harness, the chariots, the horses, the strange livery of the servants, made up of all peoples of the earth. In that procession of pride and grandeur one hardly knew what to look at, and not only the eye, but the mind, was dazzled by such gleaming of gold, purple, and violet, by THC flashing of precious stones, the glitter of brocade, pearls, and ivory. It seemed that the very rays of the sun were dissolving in that abyss of brilliancy. And though wretched people were not lacking in that throng, people with sunken stomachs, and with hunger in their eyes, that spectacle inflamed not only their desire of enjoyment and their envy, but filled them with delight and pride, because it gave a feeling of the might and invincibility of Rome, to which the world contributed, and before which the world knelt. Indeed, there was not on earth anyone who ventured to think that that power would not endure through all ages, and outlive all nations, or that there was anything in existence that had strength to oppose it. Vinicius, riding at the end of the retinue, sprang out of his chariot at sight of the apostle and Lygia, whom he had not expected to see, and, greeting them with a radiant face, spoke with hurried voice, like a man who has no time to spare, "Hast thou come? I know not how to thank thee, O Lygia. God could not have sent me a better omen. I greet thee, even while taking farewell, but not farewell for a long time. On the road I shall dispose relays of horses, and every free day I shall come to thee till I get leave to return. Farewell. Farewell, Marcus," answered Lygia. Then she added in a lower voice, "May Christ go with thee, and open thy soul to Paul's word." He was glad at heart that she was concerned about his becoming a Christian soon. Hence he answered, "Sell me, let it be as thou sayest. Paul prefers to travel with my people, but he is with me, and will be to me a companion and master. Draw aside thy veil, my delight, let me see thee before my journey. Why art thou thus hidden?" She raised the veil, and showed him her bright face and her wonderfully smiling eyes, inquiring, "Is the veil bad?" And her smile had in it a little of maiden opposition. But Vinicius, while looking at her with delight, answered, "At for my eyes, which till death would look on thee only." Then he turned to Ursus and said, "Ursus, guard her as the sight in thy eye, for she is my Domina as well as thine." Seizing her hand then, he pressed it with his lips, to the great astonishment of the crowd, who could not understand signs of such honor from a brilliant Augustan to a maiden arrayed in simple garments, almost those of a slave. "Farewell." Then he departed quickly, for Caesar's whole retinue had pushed forward considerably. The apostle Peter blessed Hinni with a slight sign of the cross, but the kindly Ursus began at once to glorify him, glad that his young mistress listened eagerly, and was grateful to him for those praises. The retinue moved on, and hid itself in clouds of golden dust. They gazed long after it, however, till Demas the miller approached, he for whom Ursus worked in the night time. When he had kissed the apostle's hand, he entreated them to enter his dwelling for refreshment, saying that it was near THC Emporium, that they must be hungry and wearied since they had spent the greater part of the day at the gate. They went with him, and, after rest and refreshment in his house, returned to the Trans-Tiber only toward evening. Intending to cross the river by the Aemilian Bridge, they passed through the Clivus Publicus, going over the Aventine, between the temples of Diana and Mercury. From that height the apostle looked on the edifices about him, and on those vanishing in the distance. Sunk in silence he meditated on the immensity and dominion of that city, to which he had come to announce the word of God. Hitherto he had seen the rule of Rome, and its legions in various lands through which he had wandered, but they were single members as it were of the power, which that day for the first time he had seen impersonated in the form of Nero. That city, immense, predatory, ravenous, unrestrained, rotten to the marrow of its bones, and unassailable in its preterhuman power, that Caesar, a fratricide, a matricide, a wife-slayer, after him dragged a retinue of bloody specters no less in number than his court, that profligate, that buffoon, but also lord of 30 legions, and through them of the whole earth, those courtiers covered with gold and scarlet, uncertain of the morrow, but mightier meanwhile than kings, all this together seemed a species of hellish kingdom of wrong and evil. In his simple heart he marveled that God could give such inconceivable almightiness to Satan, that he could yield the earth to him to knead, overturn, and trample it, to squeeze blood and tears from it, to twist it like a whirlwind, to storm it like a tempest, to consume it like a flame. And his apostle heart was alarmed by those thoughts, and in spirit he spoke to the Master, O Lord, how shall I begin in this city, to which thou hast sent MC, low feet belong seas and lands, the beasts of the field, and the creatures of the water, it owns other kingdoms and cities, and 30 legions which guard them. But I, O Lord, am a fisherman from a lake. How shall I begin, and how shall I conquer its malice? Thus speaking, he raised his gray, trembling head toward heaven, praying, and exclaiming from the depth of his heart to his divine master, himself full of sadness and fear. Meanwhile HB prayer was interrupted by Lydia. The whole city is as if on fire, said she. In fact, the sun went down that day in a marvelous manner. Its immense shield had sunk halfway behind the geniculum, the whole expanse of heaven was filled with a red gleam. From the place on which they were standing, Peter's glance embraced large expanses. Somewhat to THC right they saw the long extending walls of the Circus Maximus, above it the towering palaces of the Palatine, and directly in front of them, beyond the Forum Boreum and the Velibrum, the summit of the Capitol, with the Temple of Jupiter. But the walls and the columns, and the summits of the temples, were as if sunk in that golden and purple gleam. The parts of the river visible from afar flowed, as if in blood, arid as the sun sank moment after moment behind the mountain. The gleam became redder and redder, more and more like a conflagration, and it increased and extended till finally it embraced the seven hills, from which it extended to the whole region about. The whole city seems on fire, repeated Lydia. Peter shaded his eyes with his hand, and said, the wrath of God is upon it. When the inhabitants of Italy were freed from military service by Augustus, in consequence of which the so-called Cohors Italica, stationed generally in Asia, was composed of volunteers. The Praetorian Guards, insofar as they were not composed of foreigners, were made up of volunteers. Two in the time of the Caesars a legion was always 12,000 men. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.